What I find amazing about that is that Torah is all-encompassing. Torah is so comprehensive. Torah is illuminating and instructive. And every question that ever comes up in our lives, we always have the opportunity to look somewhere in the Torah to find the answer. Now, we may not all be educated enough to know where to find the answer or what reference we should be using to look for a particular guidance or answer. But what I want to bring to you before we get into today's topic is just a couple of things that came out at me at this week's Parsha that you may not have realized are so relevant, but maybe seem to be otherwise totally innocuous as you go through the Parsha. So let me just give two examples. There was a great tzaddik, a great Talmud Chacham in the late 1800s. He passed away in 1911. His name was Rav Shalom Mordechai Shvadron. He was the grandfather of Rav Shalom Shvadron, who was the Maggid of Yerushalayim. So his name was Rav Shalom Mordechai Shvadron. He was most importantly known for his sefer called the Tshuvas Maharsham. The Tshuvas Maharsham is a responsa. It's a tshuva sefer that talks about many, many different areas of halacha. So he was posed with the following question. There were two people who lived in the same neighborhood who absolutely hated each other. Really, they had a tremendous animosity for one another. And one of them was so angry at his friend that he took a shvua. He swore that he will never look at his friend's face again. Never look at his friend's face again. Strange kind of shvua to make. I would say just stay away from him. What do you have to make a swear for that? But that's the swear that he took upon himself. He will never look at his friend's face again. Turns out, one fine day, his friend died. And he, as the one who hated him, was actually a member of the Chever Kadisha, of the ones who were involved in burying the dead of the city. And his question was, am I allowed to be involved in preparing my friend, my enemy, for burial, when after all I made a shvua, I promised myself that I would never look at him again in my life. Now, maybe you'll say that is over once my life, once his life is over or my life is over, we are no longer bound by our shvua, by our swear that we made to each other. But here, his question was whether or not we should assume that that is still binding. Is this annoying for anybody? It's okay. Whether or not it's still binding, that was his question. So where do you look for an answer to such a strange question? The answer is in this week's Parsha. So the Maharsham writes that we look in this week's Parsha and we see that there is a reference to this discussion. The Zohar points out in this week's Parsha that we're told as the Jewish people are traveling out of Mitzrayim, as they are going through the Yam Suf, so we know that as all of the miracle was unfolding, Vayar Yisrael es Mitzrayim meis al svas hayam, the Jewish people saw that the Egyptians were dead on the other side of the river. What was that all about? Originally, they drowned in the water. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Rashi tells us on Chumash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God told the waters, you have to spit out the Egyptians and let them out on the dry land in order that the Jews should be able to see that this is real, that they should understand and internalize that the Egyptian oppressors that had been enslaving them for so many hundreds of years are not just no longer a threat, they are dead. And you can see it in front of you. Now, the Zohar HaKadosh asks, how was God allowed to do that? How could it be that he made a miracle that the Jewish people should be able to see their oppressors on the dry land if, after all, it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised them lo sosifun lirosam ad olam. God promised the Jewish people, you will never see the Egyptians again. Now ask the Zohar HaKadosh, if you were told you are never going to see them again, how is it that we are now looking at them, even though they're no longer alive, but God broke his promise? And the answer, says the Zohar HaKadosh, is, well, obviously, all Hashem meant when he said you're never going to see them again is you won't see them again while they're alive and they are a threat. But after they're dead, there's no prohibition, there's no reason to be concerned from seeing them. And of course, that is not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant. And the Maharsham said, you see from here, that even if one makes a shvua, even if that person who makes the shvua is God himself, and he promises you will never see this person again, the answer is that is only while they are alive. And the Maharsham said, from here we can extrapolate that after that person passes away, that shvua is lifted. And this member of the Chever Kadisha is able to prepare the body for burial, and there is no concern. Again, something that I assume will never come up in any of our lifetimes, but the point being that every so often you have a very unusual shaila, you have an unusual question, and you have to be a tremendous Torah giant to really know which references you're supposed to focus on. Who would have thought that the answer to such a question would be found in Parshas B'Shalach in the Zohar HaKadosh? The answer is only somebody who knows everything can know that that is where the answer is going to be found. We know that another focus in this week's Parsha is the issue of the Mun. And the Mun is a long, long discussion. We're going to talk about it in a few weeks when we speak about a different one of the issues with regard to Hilchos Shabbos, not for today's discussion. But the Gemara does tell us in Maseches Brachos, Daf Memches, that there was an evolution to Birchas HaMazon. We know that Birchas HaMazon is the blessing that we make after we eat bread. And this was not something that was instituted at one time. The Gemara says that Moshe Rabbeinu tikkun lahem Birchas HaZon. Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who made up the first bracha of Birchas HaMazon. And the question is, if that is the case, Rabbi Yosef Engel, one of the great Gedolim in Europe before the war, Rabbi Yosef Engel points out in one of his Svarim, I don't understand. Moshe Rabbeinu told them to say the bracha of Hazan Es HaKol, but what were they saying that bracha on? What did they eat? We all know they ate the man. Does that really make sense to make a Hazan Es HaKol on the man? Who said it's bread? How did the man fall? What exactly was it? It says that when the man came down, all the Jewish people were looking at each other. They didn't know what it was. It says, manhu. What is this? Where is it from? If it was a piece of bread, if it was a slice of pizza, they would all understand what it is right away. But nobody understood that because it didn't look like that. It didn't have that consistency. And the Gemara gets into a whole discussion exactly what happened when the man changed into different flavors or different things, different items. How exactly did that work? And would that impact whether or not you would make a Birchas HaMazon? Why is that relevant? Because there is another discussion in the Sefer Ramami Panu. I don't know how many of you have heard of the Ramami Panu. The Ramami Panu lived in the late 1500s, early 1600s. His name was Reb Menachem Azaria di Fanu. He was one of the Italian Gedolim. And the Ramami Panu writes in his Sefer, well, now that we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu instituting Birchas HaMazon on eating the man, what bracha did they make before they started eating the man? So what would you say? What bracha did they say? So the obvious thing everybody thinks is Hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. But how can you say min ha'aretz? It didn't grow from the ground. And that is the question that he raises. Now you'll say it's a very strange question. It's irrelevant. Never again are we going to have man falling from the sky. So why are we even busy with this? Why should we even think about it? I'll tell you in a second how this is extremely relevant, and it is probably the primary source for one of the halachas that you may not even be aware of, but you probably have inadvertently gotten involved with hundreds of times. I'll tell you in a second what I mean. So he has a discussion about which bracha you're supposed to make when you eat the man. Strange discussion. It's a discussion that only happened once in the history of the world. Who really cares? What's the difference? The answer is, well, he thinks maybe we should make a bracha hamotzi lechem min hashamayim. Instead of saying Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz, you should say Hamotzi Lechem Min HaShamayim. And there are other Achronim who disagree. The Nishmas Adam, which is written by the Chai Adam in Europe, he wrote that, no, if it looks like bread and it tastes like bread, you're going to make a Hamotzi Lechem Min Ha'aretz, irrespective of the fact that it didn't grow from the ground. If it's exactly the same consistency as bread, then that's what bracha you should make. This is all relevant because nowadays we have hydroponics. Hydroponics is a major technological breakthrough where they have figured out how to grow in what they call vertical farms. And it's a controlled agricultural environment where they have soilless farming techniques and they can be able to grow all kinds of fruits and vegetables. Instead of growing them in soil, they can grow them in water. And the question is, if you have something of that nature, if you have a vegetable that grew in a hydroponic way, what bracha would you make on that vegetable? Would you say, borei pri ha'adama? Or bori pri ha'etz on a fruit? How can I make a bracha that it grew from a tree or grew from the ground when, after all, it did not grow from a tree and it did not grow from the ground? It grew on water. Is that the same? Well, it looks like a cucumber and it tastes like one and the consistency is the same, so maybe you make the same bracha as you would any other. Or maybe you should say no. It really depends how this grows and maybe the bracha should be shahako. This was a major, major dispute over the past 120 years, I would say, about what bracha we should make on hydroponics. And many reference this issue from this week's Parsha. What bracha do you make on the man? Now you'll say it's a waste of our time. Who cares what bracha they made on the man? The answer is if you understand the fundamentals of what that discussion is about, it can inform your opinion about something else. And I would venture to say probably many of us have had hydroponic lettuce. Many places they sell hydroponic lettuce. There is less of a concern of bugs in that kind of lettuce, and it's more environmental, it's more beneficial for the environment, and many people like to eat it, and it tastes better, and it's fresher, or whatever it might be. But many of those hydroponics are a major shiloh. One of the places where that comes up is, when I have to eat maror on Pesach night, am I allowed to have maror that grew in hydroponics? Maror has to be from the ground. So would you say that this counts as being from the ground? Or would I say that if I have matzah that I need to eat on Leil HaSeder, can I use wheat that comes from these hydroponic produce centers, or would you say, no, that's not called wheat, and even if I grind it into flour, it's not called flour, and that flour that's made into bread is not called bread? All of that is a fascinating discussion that comes up from this problem in our parsha. So this is the only reason I mention it is because in every parsha, in every pasuk in Chumash, there are mountains of discussions that come out, and there is so much of it that you may say to yourself, will never really be relevant, doesn't really matter, it's totally out of my life, it doesn't really make a difference to my life, it will never happen again. And you'll be surprised to learn, the more and more you study through the different areas and vistas of halacha, you will see that everything ends up becoming relevant. My father always likes to quote that Tosus talks about a case, and he says that the Gemara sometimes brings up cases that are totally, you know, like in our imagination, possibilities that are never going to happen. And Tosa says, I'll give you an example. For example, there's a discussion that many of the poskim had about, what do you do if you take an embryo from one cow and you somehow put it into another cow and then the second cow has the baby? And Tosa says, this is like the craziest case you can ever think of. But the Gemara is talking about crazy possibilities. Yeah, this is a crazy case that happens maisim b'chol yom. This happens every single day. Our friend who's going to be working in Shaarei Tzedek this summer can tell you all about it. What exactly it means, right? So what exactly it means when you take an embryo from one person and put it into another? What is the status of that fetus? What is the status of the embryo? Who is the mother and who is not? Is it the conceive or is it the one who gives birth? Now, Tosis talks about the possibility as something that is an impossibility. But we're going to talk about the possibility anyway because we want to understand the theoretical underpinnings of that case. The answer is you have to study everything. You have to know everything. And once you know everything, then you can have the opportunity to really be enlightened into new issues that come up. That gives you a small appreciation of how great our Gedolim always were, always have been, and continue to be. That's what it means to be a Gadol. And I think it's important to make this point because in our generation we have people who are experts in one field, or they, you know, they study one area of halacha and they say, you know, I'm the expert in this. But sometimes a question comes up in that area of halacha that requires a totally different area of halacha to be able to answer it. And you have no knowledge and no expertise in that other area, or you don't have a broad base of knowledge, and therefore you may be a little bit lacking in this area of your expertise as well. I'm not saying that as a criticism, I'm just saying it as a reality. And to understand the greatness of a posek who is able to take all of this into consideration and then come to a final psak when they have so many other factors that come up. I'll give you this is not the subject of what we're talking about today, but it's interesting nonetheless. So I remember a couple of years ago, there was a question that came up. It was actually when Rav Asher Weiss's wife was in Sloan Kettering. And he was with our family. He stayed in my house for a long time at the time because he was here with his children. Different kids were coming in, but he was here for a few months. Ultimately, his wife passed away in Sloan Kettering. And I was with him almost every day, and we would go for walks. We would talk about different things. But a lot of the day, he was writing responsa. He was writing tshuvas to people who were reaching out to him about different issues. So we would sit there in the ICU, and then he would tell me at the end of the day, can you bring me this sefer tomorrow? Can you bring me that sefer? I need to look something up. And we would go on walks, and we would discuss a lot of the issues. So one of those days, there was somebody who called from Israel. His name was Professor Havlin. I don't know anything about him. But he's a religious Jew, and he had an amazing question. Anyone here ever heard of the medicine basket in the United States? No? Okay, so every insurance company has to figure out what they're going to cover and what perhaps they should not cover. How do you determine what should be covered in the insurance policy and what not? Well, it depends what your priorities are. So every country, every civilized country, has to figure out what is included in what they refer to as the medicine basket. What's reasonable to include in insurance coverage and what not? So what will you say? What would you say? Where should the cutoff be? So somebody has a headache and they need Tylenol. So should we say anybody who has a headache and needs Tylenol should be able to go to the supermarket, to the drugstore, and get Tylenol for free because people have headaches and they need to be covered? Or would you say no? It probably makes sense that insurance should cover somebody who needs physical therapy after they break their leg, and the Tylenol you'll go spend on your own money. Or would you say, well, more people in the world suffer from headaches, and therefore we should cater to more people in the world. Less people in the world break their leg, and therefore those people, when they have that problem, they'll have to deal with it on their own. How do you make these decisions? So Professor Havlin was, I think what he said was, he was the first Orthodox Jew who was asked to join this committee in Israel of the medicine basket. It's called Sal HaBriyut in Israel. It's the same name in America. It's called the medicine basket. And the question is, now, as an Orthodox Jew, we're coming, let's say they make a new evaluation every 3 or 4 years, or I don't know how it works, but every couple of years they decide what should be in, what should be out. I oversimplified it. They don't argue about Tylenol versus physical therapy. They argue about nitty-gritty details of different medications and which procedures should or should not be covered. But the question here becomes, how would an Orthodox Jew cast his vote? How exactly should he prioritize as a God-fearing Jew, as a Torah-observant Jew, how should he prioritize what his vote should be in terms of what the medicine basket should cover and what perhaps it should not? Now, where does one even begin to look for an answer to this question? Where could one even begin to look for an answer to that question? This is not a question that existed in the days of the Tanoim, certainly not in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. The Rishonim didn't have these problems, and even the Shulchan Aruch didn't have that either. So the question is, now that we have insurance policies, which is something that is relatively new, and we have coverage for certain medical issues that we may have in our lives, so who are you going to turn to find the answer to that question? Should you say, well, let's think about it as Jews. What do you say? All the pre-med. What do you say? The pre-med? So what do you think? Well, it makes sense. Take your principles that you know as a Jew and try to apply them. Well, as a Jew, what is the greatest Jewish principle when it comes to medicine? More than helping people.
Save lives.
Save lives, period, right? We save lives. We believe in life. V'chai bahem. The Torah says you should be Mechallel Shabbos to save a life. You should eat on Yom Kippur to save a life. You should do anything that's necessary to save a life. Sometimes even you're allowed to endanger your own life to save another life. So maybe I should say that as a God-fearing Jew, my vote should be that we prioritize all life-saving activities to be on the top of the list. And any money that is left over after that, maybe we'll think about other things. But how can we give money for physical therapy when we know that somebody whose life is in danger is not going to be given the treatment that they need? Is that the right answer? Maybe we should say, let's save all lives that we possibly can. Let's cover everything. And the person who unfortunately ends up with a broken leg and won't be able to ever walk again, so too bad. So he'll be him or her, whoever it may be, will end up in crutches and on a wheelchair for the rest of their lives. And okay, that's what it's going to be. Does that make sense to you? It can't be. That's ludicrous. That's insane. Should there be a cutoff? Maybe we should say, well, once he's 85 years old, we're not going to cover life-saving procedures because, you know, all right, they're already like over a certain age. Maybe we say 90 or 95. When should that be? 100? When would we say the cutoff is? So what do we say? And if you're 15 years old, then your life is valuable. And if you're 85, your life is not valuable. That's not a Jewish value. So how does this work? How do we prioritize? So where do you look for such an answer? You can't just make it up. There has to be some kind of source for an answer. So I remember like yesterday, this was like a number of years ago, but I remember it like yesterday because it made such an impression on me. We went for a walk that day. We were talking about it. He says, Shai, what do you think? That was his way of just starting the conversation. Of course, I had nothing to say. So he says, okay, so let's try to think about it. Where would you find a source to try to inform your answer on such an issue? Now, I have no idea, but he had an idea. And he literally started going through the entire Shas in his head. The entire Shas in his head. Till he gets to a Gemara Maseches Nedarim. Many people don't even know there's a Masechta called Nedarim. So the Gemara Maseches Nedarim has a fascinating dispute among the Tanaim. The Gemara Maseches Nedarim, right? This is how our class works. For anyone who's new, by the way, this is how it goes. So the Gemara Maseches Nedarim talks about the following case. What happens when I have two cities right next to each other, and one city does not have any food, and the other city has an excess of food? So what's the halacha? Do I have to give my extra food that I have in my house to save the lives of the other people in the neighboring town? What's the answer? You say yes. Why is there anyone who's not saying yes? Yes, resounding yes. The answer is I have to save other people's lives. Now, what if I only have enough food for myself and they have no food? So do I have to give up my food to save their lives? The answer is resounding no. Why not? Because why is this person's life more important than my life? And therefore, if I have food to take care of myself to survive, I don't have to give up my food to be able to help somebody else survive. Okay, so far so good? Now, let's change the case a little bit. Let's say I have enough water and I have enough water to live on forever. We have a water stream, everything's okay. The neighboring town has no water to drink. So the same rules apply. If I'm going to give up the water that I need to live, I don't have to give it up. Let them figure out what to do. But if I have excess water, I have to give them the excess. Says the Gemara, what happens in the following case? When I have two cities next to each other, my city has not only enough water to drink, but we also have enough water to do the laundry. The other city does not have any water at all. They're going to die. They're going to die because they have no water to drink. Do I have to give my laundry water for them to be able to survive? What do you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you think yes?
Because
I can survive without laundry. That's what you say. I can survive without laundry. Now, I can't survive without drinking any water, so I don't have to give up my cup of water. But the laundry water, all right, so we'll have dirty clothing. What are you going to do? We'll figure out what to do, or we won't. But it doesn't make sense that I should have clean clothing and my neighbor should die because of that. So that's one opinion in the Mishnah. And the other opinion in the Mishnah is no. My town is allowed to save not only our drinking water, but we're also allowed to save our water that we set aside for the laundry. But setting aside the water for the laundry means they're going to die. They have no water. So how can that be? This is a big discussion in the Netziv and others who try to figure out what exactly does this mean. Rav Asher Weiss came to the conclusion what it means is that yes, it's true. Pikuach nefesh, saving a life, is the most important value. But when we're dealing with a society, when we're dealing with a city, when we're dealing with a civilization, it is not the only factor. To have a functioning civilization, you cannot only have people who are surviving, who are living. You have to have a thriving community which is composed and comprised of many different things that all come together with that issue, and it is not specific to one thing that is necessary. We need water to drink. We need water to do laundry. We cannot have a society without laundry that's able to be done. We're not going to be able to survive that. While it's true, yes, technically we could survive, but that's not a functioning society. And what he said is, you see from here, that when you have a community that has a question of pikuach nefesh, there are many other factors that need to be taken into equation. Not only the bottom line of will people live or not, there are other things that we need to think about as well before making a determination in this kind of question. So he said in this case as well, when I have a situation when the medicine basket has to be determined, how are we going to figure out what to include and what not to include? The answer is, it's not only about saving people's lives. It's also about we can have a society where every person who breaks his leg is going to be a cripple for the rest of his life because he can't afford to have physical therapy. That would be an unreasonable demand. That would be an unreasonable request of anyone. Wouldn't make sense. That wouldn't be a society. So again, these are issues where maybe if you read that Gemara Maseches Nedarim, who would have ever thought that such a crazy case is going to come up? One city has water to do laundry, the other one doesn't have any water at all. It sounds very strange. The answer is, if you understand the fundamentals of what we're learning from each issue, you never know where that can be applied and how important that can be in terms of another contemporary question that will come up. So that is just the background. And again, we can do this on every parsha. You can have a million things that come out of every pasuk, things that we never would have imagined. But I'm just challenging you to think about creativity. Sometimes you have to be creative to figure out lehavin davar mitoch davar, where things fit together, where perhaps things don't fit together, how we can extrapolate something from one issue and carry over the fundamentals to another issue that may come up. And it's something that is very exciting about halacha, very challenging about halacha, but very, very interesting, and continues to make halacha extremely current and very, very important for all of us. So